Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about contemporary German foreign policy. Have German interests really been subsumed into a common European position on the world stage, and why did Berlin so badly miscalculate its relations with Putin's Russia?
Looking at the situation of Germany at the present day, and the present day is October 2022, the foreign policy of Germany, Germany's position in the international order, has obviously very much been affected by the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the sense, a very strong sense, that the policies of Chancellor Merkel and her government are, in a way, sort of strengthened Russia by creating a dependency from the German economy on the Russians, and also by creating among Russian policymakers a sense that Germany would be pliable and that Germany, as the most potent of the continental European states, not a state with nuclear power, of course, but nevertheless, nuclear armed power, but nevertheless, the leading economy, would be one that vitiated any European response to Russian aggression. I think it's reasonable, therefore, to ask the question whether Merkel's policy should be seen primarily in these terms, or whether there are longer term trends that can be brought into the equation. Now, to my mind, both play a role. I think there's no accident that Angela Merkel, who in many senses was a daughter of East Germany, there's no surprise that she had an attitude towards Russia, and indeed the Soviet Union prior to that, that was different from that of previous CDU leaders, all of whom, of course, came from West Germany, and all of whom as well came from a Catholic background in which there was a more clear-cut ideological hostility to the Soviet Union. And I think there is no doubt that a change in generational leadership among the CDU was important, but so also the particular context of Merkel's policies. Because it's worth bearing in mind that although you can trace a link between the Ostpolitik of Germany in the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s, and the policy towards Russia of Chancellor Merkel, it's worth bearing in mind that all the previous protagonists of that policy were very much people of the SPD. They were people of the left, maybe not a left in terms of a Jeremy Corbyn, but nevertheless a left in the terms of German politics. And what is interesting in the case of Merkel is that this attitude, which had been seen with Gerhard Schröder, was actually bridged into mainstream CDU policy and therefore, as it were, became the policy of the German establishment. Now, where does one think about this? Part of it clearly is economic self-interest. There is no doubt at all about that. There was a strong sense among German financial and economic views and interests that the fall of communism represented an enormous opportunity for Germany, an opportunity both in terms of new markets, but also in terms of cheaper labor. So you get German car factories moving to Slovakia, you get the Deutsche Bahn trying to develop rail corridors into the Balkans, et cetera, et cetera. And it is part and parcel of that, a crucial part and parcel of that, was the attempt to develop an energy infrastructure in which German industry became a key, had a key comparative advantage through having access to inexpensive Russian energy, and also that this was seen, and this is highly ironic and also shows how people have to be very careful about anticipating things, this was seen as a more predictable source of energy than the energy from the Middle East, Iran, the Islamic world, and therefore as one that would again give Germany a comparative advantage. All of those points are clear cut. And there was also the particular, in the case of energy, the particular, as it were, sharpener that Chancellor Merkel made rather foolish promises to do with getting rid of nuclear power in Germany, policies that really ensured an even greater reliance on Russia, and therefore was strategically, to put it mildly, foolish. I think that's being polite. Now, there is, of course, a political dimension that is also worth thinking about, and that is this. German policymakers, in the sense of those who like to think in geopolitical terms, have been, I think it's fair to say, since the 60s, have revived older traditions of being wary about the United States. In the late 60s, these were related in part to uneasiness about the Vietnam War. They were related to uneasiness specifically about President Nixon. Indeed, you saw the same attitudes taken by Edward Heath in Britain. These were factors that helped to encourage him to push ahead, despite the costs, in joining the European Economic Community, the forerunner of the European Union. In the case of Germany, there was the idea that Germany, in a way, could sit between the East and the West. And this rested on a whole host of ideas. This rested in part on the notion that the only possibility of reviving the idea of the unification of Germany, of West and East Germany, was that, as it were, an end to the Cold War, a neutralization of Germany, akin to that which had been seen with Austria in 1955, and that this meant a need to move away from the West. On top of that, there was a sense that West Germany had only a limited degree of freedom over its policymaking as part of the Western system. There were a number of factors playing a role. And in, of course, as we know, in some cases, there was the active attempt of the Soviet Union to interfere in and use subversion in the in West German domestic politics, and of course, placing agents in senior positions around the Bundeschancellor was part and parcel of the same thing. But I think that's actually only relatively minor. I think the major issues one's looking at is a uneasiness about America and a wish to take a distinctive policy for Germany and an interest in the idea of being a third force in Europe. Interestingly enough, that last idea, of course, was also one in a different context expressed by President de Gaulle of France. Interestingly also, French unease about West German Ostpolitik sat alongside French desires to develop and to make sure that they were in charge of, as it were, continental European relations with the Soviet Union. Now, to a degree, in the 2000s, these ideas were powerfully strengthened. They didn't need to be revived, they'd been there right the way through, but were powerfully strengthened, renewed, as it were, with a fresh bout of disinclination or hostility towards the United States. German policymakers had found George H.W. Bush and President Clinton, both policymakers who they rather liked the mood music from, and also they liked the fact that both George H.W. Bush and Clinton were quite pro-German. And indeed, in some respects, moving away from what had been the alignment with Britain seen much more clearly under President Reagan. In the 2000s, of course, this went into a free fall. The Germans did not like the American policy of President George W. Bush. They didn't like the war on terror. They didn't like the idea of war with Iraq. They found it much easier to align with France, and in a very, in a way that really splintered the opportunity for the Americans to have the same international coalition in their 2003 war with Iraq that they'd had in the 1991 coalition war against Iraq. On top of that, George W. Bush had identified his concerns about Russia as being part and parcel of what was going on, and he wished to extend NATO to include Ukraine and Georgia. And of course, the German policy was very much opposed to that. They were opposed both to the specifics in terms of what they thought about the commitments and what they thought about the implications for relations with Russia. And they were also opposed to the generality in the sense that they didn't like the idea that America was taking a line on European policy. Now, this, of course, was an ironic contrast to the situation in the 1990s, when the European states had been only too delighted to have America play a prominent role in ending the Bosnian War in 1995 and in using air power against Serbia during the Kosovo crisis of 1999. In the 2000s, the policy attitude changed in the German case, and one sees then a rolling out of the situation that in many senses, and I don't think sufficient people have pointed this out, the appalling nature of President Putin's assault on Ukraine is in some respects a consequence and sequel to his assault on Georgia. And indeed, I think the lesson was pretty much clear cut. If you as a state wish to consider joining NATO and wish to have friendly and favorable relations with the Americans, then we will thrash you to a point that you cannot do that. And I think there is a common theme in the Georgia crisis, which of course the Russians rapidly were successful in the Ukraine crisis, which has been very different. They were rapidly successful in seizing Crimea, and the Germans, of course, were not really interested in taking any significant stance then. And then one has the situation of the present crisis. Now, we will all have our own views, and it is very difficult to speculate in the absence of access to government papers. I have the sense that the Germans would have preferred a settlement of the Ukraine crisis prior to the conflict, in which the Russians had been able to have the annexation of the territories that they wanted at that stage, and that then there had been, as it were, a neutralized and vulnerable, it has to be said, Ukraine, with possibly Russian subversion helping to ensure a pro-Russian government, but with nothing really rocking the boat as far as the Germans were concerned. Now, my own view is that Chancellor Merkel left Germany in a weak position, both in terms of foreign policy and in terms of defense. But of course, the strength of German public finances and the strength of the German economy means that Germany does not take the consequences for that that would arise for a less successful economic state. As far as other aspects of German foreign policy are concerned, and very briefly, Germany, of course, followed a policy towards China, which could be termed appeasement, if you wish to use that emotive term. It certainly was one of putting economic interest above the construction of any deterrent security pact intended to limit expansionism of China. And to that extent, ironically, Germany at the present moment, as one of the world's most successful economies, is actually following the policy, or followed until very recently, which the United States followed in the late 30s, because of course the United States then, as the world's leading economy, actively, in effect, appeased Germany and Japan by doing nothing whatsoever to deter them until such time as the situation was really too late. If one then looks at other aspects, within the European Union as a whole, Germany has been very important in both enforcing settlements and policies designed to protect its economic and fiscal interests, and also ones which, it has to be said, have jeopardized good relations with other powers. Most people, alas, don't seem to care very much about the Greeks, but it has to be said that when you have a degree of suspicion on the towards Germany from powers that are concerned about Russia, such as Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, this is not a benign situation. There is also a sense that the German-French arrangement has had a malign consequence in the European Union. And if you are to think, and obviously listeners will have their own views about this, but if you are to think that Britain's departure from the European Union was not only an issue for Britain that may well not work out advantageously, but actually was also foolish for the European Union and weakened that, then one cannot but say that Chancellor Merkel, as the most powerful European leader in 2016, bears a large responsibility for the debacle of the negotiations by David Cameron to try and ease those terms. Now, it's well understood that David Cameron was not a competent prime minister. He did not have an ability to really understand the situation. We know that, but the fact of the matter is, more astute leaders might have played a better role in helping to take a different direction forward. That, again, is a matter of opinion, and people will have very different views on that topic. But if you take those criteria, and you could take the other criteria that actually the European Union, or the people that dominated it and who wanted a so-called deepening of the Union, wanted Britain out and actually wanted Brexit. If you think that is the case, then that's a different point of view. But if we are to take the Chancellor Merkel at face value and that she didn't want it, then she certainly was incompetent at best. Another aspect, it has to be said, of foreign policy was one towards migration, immigration, and of course linked to that in particular, what really provoked an enormous crisis in the two teens, which was the Syrian humanitarian and political crisis. And again, it has to be said that Chancellor Merkel's policies helped to create a sense of destabilization surrounding the migration issue, which not only affected German domestic politics, but also affected domestic politics across continental Europe. And indeed, it might be argued, played a role in the Brexit debate in Britain. And again, it has to be said that the German government in the Syrian policy was, to put it mildly, useless, and that being willing to spend a certain amount of money on humanitarian consequences, whilst good for those who were refugees, was scarcely going to stop, deter, or influence President Assad or his backers. So German policy in the domestic sphere, people can discuss its values and its virtues. They could say that and point out that the German economy has less structural rigidities than 20 years ago, that it's managed to tackle many of the difficulties without having significant labor disputes, that yes, it has had a rise of political extremism on the left as well as the right, but on the other hand, that has not led to an overthrow of the system, etc., etc. But on the other hand, there are aspects of German domestic politics and society that one could be a little bit more critical about. And on the international side, I think it's fair to say that there is quite a lot to be sceptical about.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Black. There's a huge amount to get ourselves into here. And I want to start, if I may, by asking about the difference between rhetoric and reality from Berlin in its foreign policy. The way in which Germany has phrased itself for decades now in its international relations is to, you know, subsume itself into the European Union. But since the creation of the foreign security common policy pillar following the Maastricht Treaty in the early 1990s, we haven't really seen a European Union, a cohesive European Union foreign policy develop in the way that 30 or so years ago many people thought it would. Do you feel that it's, you know, Germany has tried to create a German-influenced European policy, or but it just hasn't worked out, and the Balkans would be a case in point there, or actually was it all stuff and nonsense? You know, there was the discussion of being subsumed within a European political identity, but actually German foreign policy has always followed the needs and requirements as perceived from Berlin, rather than what, for example, in Paris or any other European capital it might be perceived to be.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I think that there are several things one can say about this. First of all, obviously, German policy changes by administration and by context. But nevertheless, you're right. There are consistent issues one needs to think about there. I think a German policymaker, if you could have him or her in the room at the moment, would argue that a strong EU is in the interests of Germany and would come along with this hilarious assumption, which is, you know, the way certainly politicians do things, that clearly they must therefore agree. And therefore, that whatever one does to strengthen the EU is strengthening Germany, whatever one does to strengthen Germany strengthens the EU. Obviously, this is hogwash. I mean, for example, there's no real German interest in mutualizing the European Union debt. There's no real interest in moving to subsume the a society which really is not interested in the commitments of a European, as it were, a European power that might have to face real difficulties. So let's give a basic point. You mentioned the Balkans. I hope this doesn't happen, but were it to be the case that there is significant instability in Albania or Macedonia, were there to be significant instability in Kosovo, were there to be a revival of problems in Bosnia, were there to be Russian influence in Serbia causing difficulties, all issues that have been discussed both publicly and privately over the last 3 years, then of course, the Germans would expect somebody else to sort it out for them. They would expect NATO to sort it out, and they'd expect the Americans to play a major role. They'd want the Brits and the French to play a major role. The last people they would want to play a major role would be the Germans. Then if you look further afield to areas that abut on the European Union and its interests and pretensions, whether you're thinking of the Maghreb, Northwest Africa, whether you're thinking of the Middle East, whether you're thinking of the Black Sea, again, the Germans really don't want to play a role. So in other words, they have a very fair weather attitude to international relations. Now, it could be said that that is the nature of not just German policy, but EU foreign policy. Because in the case of EU foreign policy, you cannot but think the same. There is very little sign of a kinetic capacity. In other words, a capacity to use force in an effective and, if necessarily, brutal fashion. The only state that seems able to do so in continental Europe in terms of a really lethal power is France, because it is a nuclear power, and in a non-lethal power, probably a non-nuclear power, sorry, very lethal, Poland. And I think it's worth saying that Germany, in other words, relies on an impression of influence rather than a reality of military power. And that always works as long as nobody else says boo. Now, one of the great problems is President Putin has said boo, and deterrence failed. The British and the Americans and the Ukrainians and the Poles went out of their way, including in the revelation in public of security information, including in real time, to show that the Russians were preparing for an invasion. And it has to be said that the European Union did not rise to the challenge until after it had happened. And the same is true of the Germans.
I wonder, and it's always difficult discussing a psychology of a nation, let alone of a government, but the psychology of, certainly until now, only spending a little over 1% of GDP on defence, the long-running view that the Bundeswehr was there to be a peacekeeping force and not to be used in offensive operations. So it is now in an offensive operation mode. Should we see this as the long shadow from the Second World War and a fear of a new Wehrmacht creating itself with all that involved, or is this actually just almost like an excuse that's used in order to let the Americans and to some extent the British and French do the heavy lifting, whilst Germany does the talking at most?
Well, I think that's really interesting. It's certainly not a legacy from the last war, because, of course, if you think about it, the largest force on the inter-German border during the late 50s and 60s was, in fact, the Bundeswehr. And the Bundeswehr was commanded by generals who had fought the Soviet Union during World War II. And as we know from the discussions among ex-generals in the late 40s and early 50s about recreating a German army, they were only too happy to present themselves and to see themselves as key allies of the West in any confrontation with the Soviet Union. So I don't think that that was the case then. I think it's not so much the legacy of World War II. I think it's more the legacy of the 1960s and the legacy of the generations that came through from then onwards. And I think the kind of the opposition to the Vietnam War, the 1968 generation, which was very powerful movement in the West German universities, the effect of East German front neutralism programs, which had a very successful propaganda in some respect, and then again the opposition to the deployment of Pershing and cruise missiles in the 80s, and the way in which this particularly influenced young and not so young SPD politicians, the rise of the Greens, who were took exactly the same line, even more so. I think all of those were tremendously important. So, no, I think it's in a way, I'm not saying you're being lazy, but I think this attitude that it's a legacy of World War II is lazy. I think actually it's much more a consequence of latter stage Cold War.
Mm. Oh, that's a very interesting point. I want to turn now to the issue of the moment, which is Germany's relations with Russia. And, you know, as a fundamental part of that, the German government's decision to make the country energy dependent on Russia. How do you weigh the various arguments which led to this calamitous decision? Essentially, they're near neighbors, they can supply power, it's the cheapest and easiest option. Or is it a sense that interdependency is good, and the more interdependent we are, even with regimes which are not like us, the more they will become like us? Was there some of that naivety there? Was, of course, actually what it meant was that Western democracies would become dangerously dependent on more authoritarian regimes. But what was that, the genuine thinking, or should we just see it almost as like a series of mistakes, such as Chancellor Merkel's really knee-jerk reaction to the Fukushima disaster, where instantly saying, right, we're not having more nuclear power, and therefore Russia is a quick fix solution to that. So to what extent is this an overarching philosophy? To what extent is it almost an accidental response to incidents that happen? And to what extent was it just a simple case of, this makes economic sense?
Well, I think that's, again, very interesting. I think it's all of those, but I think there are other factors that are worth bearing in mind. Let me again bring up the Cold War. You will recall how in the 1980s, the American government, as a key element, tried to prevent the development of European, Western European dependence on Soviet fuel, both oil and natural gas, and they were really concerned about investments in pipelines. And of course, although not all that investment was West Germany was the major source of that investment. So again, we are looking at very long-term issues. You may also recall, if you think of the Nord Stream pipeline direction, that this again was intended to ensure that Russian, prior to that, Soviet energy supplies could reach Germany without having to go through Poland and without actually having to, as it were, be vulnerable to not just paying transit charges, but actually to political intervention accordingly. So this was in many senses a Russian-German political as well as economic pact, geopolitical pact. It was seen as that in the late Cold War period. And in a way, what one has got is a current iteration of it. Now, I'm sure that you could get Gerhard Schroeder there to tell you how all this would have led to international good understanding, blah, 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 blah. And I'm sure lots of other people paid by Gazprom would say exactly the same. And I suppose also people would argue this was constructive engagement, etc., etc. But the reality was, as you exactly say, that what it has done, as was anticipated by the Reagan government, was provide a degree of German subservience to Russia. Now, I'm not in any way doubting the wish of people like the current chancellor to try and press Putin to take a different stance. The problem is, as he has said, President Putin isn't interested in listening, and the difficulty then is that they're in a vulnerable position. So I think there is a practical problem there. It's quite clear that domestic nuclear power was the best solution in strategic terms. Germany does not sit on an area of heavy volcanic or earthquake activity. The environmental damage, ironically, we've already seen as far greater from moving fuel through the Baltic, and then it being sabotaged. In fact, I'm rather surprised to not hear from Greta Thunberg and the other Greens about how awful President Putin is being, but presumably that is because they seem to provide a chorus to denounce America and international capitalism, and they give the Russians a kind of easy run on it.
Well, a last question, because we're running out of time, very sadly, but a last question would be, how much do you think now Germany is seen as a leader in European foreign policy, or has it really for a long time, Merkel was seen as, the first chancellor of Europe, the most significant, the most long-lasting, the most far-seeing leader Europe has. It's early days to come to a judgment about Olaf Scholz, of course, but do you sense that other countries in Europe, or indeed beyond, wait for Germany to take a lead? Or really has that sense of leadership been lost?
Well, that again is fascinating. I mean, a lot does depend upon what happens in bigger picture stuff. In other words, this: at the present moment, German moral authority has been fractured, and I noticed I was being interviewed several times by Polish television. The loathing they have for German policy, it almost comes off the cameras. I think, on the other hand, I suspect two factors will help the Germans in the medium term. One is a sense of concern and unpredictability to do with the United States. If it looks that as if a isolationist will win the next American presidential election, and even more if that's Donald Trump, because he's regarded as highly unpredictable. But even if it isn't Trump, if an isolationist is seen as likely to win, then I think that the German influence will increase greatly. Next, I think that the amount of money the Germans have and the parlous financial position of so many European states puts them in a very strong position. And as minor factors, President Macron is looking a less successful second term leader than the first term, and his political party movement is in disarray. So what might happen to France after him is unclear. And that again puts the emphasis on Germany. And as far as Britain is concerned, the last period of time in Britain has not led to an enormous amount of confidence in Britain's abilities to substantiate its understandings or promises. So that again, which is unfortunate, because I think there was the potential, in the late 2010s after Brexit, there was the potential that Britain could still use its good relations in Eastern Europe and in the Baltic to be a major European player. That's looking much less likely at the moment. So I think the situation is such that Germany isn't equal to the challenge, but it might well be thrust back on the German shoulders.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. We must draw a line under it there, unfortunately. But we're coming towards the end of this series of podcasts about the history of Germany. And in the next episode, we will be looking at the long view of German history from the Middle Ages through to the present day, looking at themes of continuity and also of change. Professor Jeremy Black, whose Brief History of Germany is out now in paperback. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.